From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we remember William Maxwell, the much-loved writer and editor who died Monday at the age of 91. Maxwell was a fiction editor at The New Yorker from 1936 to 75, working with such writers as J.D. Salinger, Vladimir Nabokov, and John Cheever. We'll listen back to an interview with Maxwell and speak with a younger writer who considered him a mentor and close friend, Alec Wilkinson. Also, Henry Sheehan reviews the new film Space Cowboys, directed by and starring Clint Eastwood. It's about three aging astronauts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Republican presidential nominee George W. Bush started his post-convention campaign today with a train tour of four states. Mark Newtbar reports from member station WDUQ.
George W. Bush and his running mate Dick Cheney gave their speeches from the back of the 26-car Change the Tone train. The crowd of about 2,000 cheered his every word and were especially excited when he told them that he would fight for the working class.
We hear the voices of the people who work for a living, and we recognize taxes on the working people are the highest they have been as a percent of our economy since World War II. We know the surplus is not the government's money. The surplus is the people's money.
Bush also promised to improve Social Security, strengthen the military, and took a swipe at the current administration when he said he would not base his opinions on the latest poll. From Pittsburgh, the train travels through Ohio, Michigan, and finally ends its trip Sunday in Springfield, Illinois. For NPR News, I'm Mark Newtbar in Pittsburgh.
The California power crisis entered its fifth day today as the state swelters through a near-record heat wave. The agency that operates most of California's electrical grid issued a Stage 1 emergency, which calls for voluntary limits on power consumption. On each of the previous 4 days, the agency has called Stage 2 emergencies, which cut power to certain industrial and commercial customers. On Tuesday and Wednesday, officials said they were close to calling for rolling blackouts across the state. Experts are saying this hurricane season may not be as bad as they earlier thought. Colorado Public Radio's Teresa Schiavone has more.
We can expect 11 named storms, 7 hurricanes, and 3 major hurricanes, according to tropical meteorologist William Gray and his team of hurricane watchers at Colorado State University. This was the team's original prediction. They had revised their forecast upward in early June to include more storms because of La Niña activity, a mass of cold water in the eastern Pacific near the equator, which produces winds that spawn hurricanes. But La Niña has weakened. The surface temperature of the Atlantic has gone up, and air pressure on the surface has changed, making the development of hurricanes slightly less likely. Gray tells us to expect an active hurricane season, but one likely weaker than those of recent years. For NPR News, I'm Teresa Schiavone in Denver.
Wildfires continue to gain ground in much of the West, where hot, dry conditions are helping what officials say is shaping up to be the worst wildfire season in 50 years. In Boise, Idaho today, 600 soldiers from Fort Hood, Texas, completed a crash course in firefighting. They're being sent to help mop up hot spots left by an Idaho fire, freeing up experienced firefighters to deal with the part of the fire that's still spreading. In stocks today, the Dow gained 61 points to close at 10,768 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. Union workers at Verizon Communications are threatening to walk off the job at midnight tomorrow if negotiators can't reach agreement on a contract. Both sides said today that the union is reviewing a company proposal designed to address workers' concerns about wages, benefits, job security, working conditions, and efforts to unionize non-union workers at the company's wireless unit. The unions represent more than 85,000 workers in 12 eastern states and the District of Columbia. Alaska Airlines says it's completed inspections on 12 of 17 grounded MD-80 jets. The airline's inspecting jack screws on the planes after disclosing that a tool used to measure wear on the part may have given erroneous readings. The grounding of the planes led to the cancellation of dozens of flights on the West Coast. Deborah Brandt reports from member station KUOW in Seattle.
Alaska Air customers are being advised to check the status of their flights on the company's website following the cancellation or delay of nearly 100 flights. The inspections were ordered after federal regulators became concerned about the tool used to check the space between the thread on the jack screw and the nut that holds it in place. The tool may at times give an incorrect reading. The FAA has also told other airlines to check jack screws on their MD-80s as well as DC-9s. A worn jack screw is suspected in the January crash of Alaska Airlines Flight 261 that killed 88 people off Southern California. Alaska Air hopes to have the jack screw checks completed within a day. For NPR News, I'm Deborah Brandt in Seattle.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index gained 27 points or 0.7%. It closed at 3,787. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from eLoan, an online home loan company offering loan tracking, personal loan consulting, and products from 70 national lenders. On the web at eloan.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we remember the much-loved, although not widely known, writer and editor William Maxwell. He died earlier this week at the age of 91. Maxwell was the author of several novels and short story collections. From 1936 to 75, he was a fiction editor at The New Yorker, where he worked with such writers as John Updike, John Cheever, Vladimir Nabokov, J.D. Salinger, and Mary McCarthy. Updike described Maxwell's voice as one of the wisest in American fiction, as well as one of the kindest. In a few minutes, we'll hear an interview recorded with Maxwell in 1995, the year he won the Gold Medal for Fiction of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Yesterday, I spoke with Alec Wilkinson, who has written for The New Yorker since 1980. Wilkinson considered Maxwell his mentor and close friend. They met when Wilkinson was a child, and his father and Maxwell were best friends. Wilkinson dedicated three of his books to Maxwell. Wilkinson was included in one of Maxwell's dedications. And Maxwell wrote the introduction to Wilkinson's book, Midnights, which has just been published in paperback. We talked first about Maxwell's writing.
He was a terrific, elegant stylist, immensely succinct, extremely complicated construction to his novels and stories, but all done to appear as if no effort had been expended at all. Only the most careful reader would be aware of the intricate architecture and the work that had been done to lay a word upon word as if he were building a stone wall. But he's a meticulous craftsman, a writer's writer. He was very fond of a remark that had been made, by a writer named John Hall Wheelock. I'm roughly paraphrasing, that writing involves the imposition of a line of words on a line of feeling. And I think more than any other writer I can think of, the emotional core of Maxwell's work is always paramount and profound. Poets adore him, I know.
Maxwell was a longtime fiction editor at The New Yorker, and among the many illustrious writers he edited were J.D. Salinger, Vladimir Nabokov, John Updike. Tell us a little bit about his reputation as an editor.
There was no one better. He was the great fiction editor of the middle and late period of the 20th century. But he was, as remarkable as his stature as an editor is, I think he's a much better writer. He was able to be such an acute editor, I think partly out of a great generosity of spirit. He was never, unlike any editor I've ever otherwise known, except perhaps William Shawn, he never appeared threatened by another writer's work. He never felt an obligation to impose his own taste upon another writer's work. He delighted in varieties of style, and even though he was a complicated stylist himself, the difference in style, for instance, from John Updike to Salinger to Frank O'Connor, another one of Maxwell's great writers, and to Nabokov is as broad a range as I can think of the period in English.
He worked with you on some of your writing, and you say that he would take his scissors and cut up your sentences and rearrange them and paste them back together. Tell us more about this method and what you got out of it.
Well, he surely never worked with a writer less developed whose work was in more of a raw state than mine was, simply because I didn't start writing till I was 24. I was a rock and roll musician before that, And I just had this idea to start doing this. And so there was a lot to clean up. There was, it was like you had bought a piece of property that on which no one had cut the grass or attended to the shrubs for a long time, and you just had to get out there and clean things up. So he would really do that. I remember he, in my first book, I had a scene, a fairly long chapter, with part of which was a monologue involving one character, and then there was it was followed by a scene involving this in two characters, one of them, the one who had spoken the monologue, and he took out the scissors and glue and combined the two scenes so that into something that was quite comical, because you now had one man going on in a rather sort of gassy monologue being interrupted constantly by somebody in the background who was having a kind of antagonistic conversation with him. And it was that sort of thing that began to make me aware of, you know, I'm sure plenty of other editors might have read the same chapter and kind of thrown up their hands and thought it was hopeless. But Bill would really, and on that particular day, we had sentences all over the desk, and I kept sort of shifting them around. I remember his losing patience with me and saying, if you think this is a game, it isn't. Put those sentences down. But we just, you know, that was as radical a piece of editorial intervention as I ever saw him engage in. But it was what I think a writer valued and depended on and leaned on Maxwell for was his judgment. And I always felt that if I showed something to Bill and he read it and found it passable, then there was no other judgment I cared for above that. No one I knew was capable of either greater penetration or greater certainty or greater estimation of what value, if any, something I had contained. And I've heard this from all of the writers whose names you mentioned earlier. Have also more or less, we all seem to be in agreement about the benefit of his company, his counsel, his estimation of your work.
And I believe William Maxwell worked with you more as a friend than as a professional paid editor.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Well, yeah, Maxwell was my father's closest friend. And when I started writing, I knew one of Bill's daughters, Brookie. I actually knew them both, Kate and Brookie, but it happened to be that I saw Brookie at one point and she knew that I was writing and asked her father if he would look at what I had done. And at the same time, my father had also said to Bill, would you take a look at this? And he had already left. I got to the New Yorker in 1980. Bill retired from the New Yorker in, I think, 1976. So we never actually worked together through anything but love, really.
We'll hear more from Alec Wilkinson after we listen back to a 1995 interview with William Maxwell. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. William Maxwell died this week at the age of 91. He was the author of several novels and short story collections and was a fiction editor at The New Yorker from 1936 to 75. Maxwell was born in the small town of Lincoln, Illinois, where he lived until moving to Chicago at the age of 14. Much of his fiction was set in the past, in towns like Lincoln. I spoke with him in 1995 after the publication of a collection of new and old stories called All the Days and Nights. A lot of the stories in your new collection come out of memories of your childhood. How much do you feel that your memory of your past has been your subject as a writer?
I think about three quarters of the time, actually. When I was first beginning to write, I wrote largely out of the present. And was alert for any situation taking place around me that could make a story. But the present, though very pleasant, didn't seem to go very deeply into anything. And memories sit on the back of the stove like soup, and they get richer and richer from the things they attract to them, and their wonderful kind of accidental quality. But I also have a kind of abnormal memory, really. My memories go back, as far as I can make out, to when I was 2 years old. And I have quite vivid memories of what before I was four. And it isn't that I haven't forgotten things, but I have remembered things, more things than people usually do. And in my old age, there's an additional vividness to them, and detail. And the detail is sometimes so astonishing that I feel everything is there. Everything that ever happened to me is there. It's a matter of unhooking it and bringing it out to the light.
Are you saying that your past has become more vivid to you as you've gotten older?
Yes, much more vivid.
Is there anything that would explain that?
I think it's a common phenomenon. But also, there's, say I'm 86, there's a breakdown in the sense of the divisions of time between past, present, and future. The future is problematical, and the present is rather meditative because I'm not involved in an active job. And I read and wander around the house and garden and do things that don't interfere with any kind of meditative process. So there's nothing to prevent the accidental memory from getting into your mind. And I do think memories are attached. Something brings them up. They don't usually force their way up like air through water. But I have had a sense of that the past is no longer different from the present. That I can live in the past as I live in the present. I think some part of my life that I enjoyed very much, and I think, well, enjoy it. It's still here. You're in it, even though the people I haven't seen for 30 years.
You know, in the story that we were reading from before, what he was like, one of the characters described himself as being in the age of funerals, or is always going to
yes.
funerals. Have you outlived a lot of your friends?
Yes. I have outlived three very close friends. And I think about them quite often. I've also outlived people of the older generation who were very kind and did wonderful things for me that I think of with love and gratitude.
Some people really say that people who they've loved who have passed are still with them in a way that they never expected. Do you ever feel that way?
Spooks, you mean?
Well, I don't mean like actual ghosts, but just feeling somebody's presence.
Yes. People often speak of it, really, and they speak of it as if they don't entirely rule out the possibility of ghosts. I think there's another way that people are kept, and that is someone who's especially dear to you, so dear that you can't face the idea of never seeing them again. You take on certain of their qualities. My mother was a very outgoing, hospitable, and quite happy woman. And I'm rather introverted and tend to be shy with strangers and like to be alone, like to read. And when she died, I was only a little boy, and I wasn't ready to give her up. And I haven't given her up. I think about her quite often. As I'm older, I remember her face more vividly. But I also am aware that that I have a kind of sociable life. I don't say that it isn't me, but it's a part of me that developed because I took part of her into my nature rather than let her die.
It was a long time ago that she died.
It was
1918 or 19.
Immense time ago.
Yeah. You've written about her a lot.
Yes.
So you think you became more sociable?
I think so. Happy with people. Because she was always happy with people.
Losing her when you were, I think it was 10 years old, to the flu epidemic, it must have made you think that at any moment, someone who you love could just suddenly disappear. Because people were dying all around during that epidemic. I mean, so many yes. Americans died. Were you always, like, bracing for that?
After that?
Mm-hmm.
No. My father was a very strong character and a physically strong man. And once when I was a little boy, I was in a boat on the Illinois River with my father and mother, and he was fishing, and we were far out in the middle of the river, and a sudden thunderstorm came up, and there were white caps on the waves, and it was quite a way back to the dock. And my father said to get down the bottom of the boat, and my mother was a heavy woman, so we had to pull quite a lot to get her in a hurry through the water. However, we stepped out of the boat just as the cloudburst came down. And as long as he lived, and I think I have it still, the feeling of being safe because of him, safe because he was an honest man, safe because he was a decent man, and safe because he was physically strong. So what the effect my mother's death had on me was really that things happen that you don't want to happen, that you can't bear to have happen, and that you must somehow learn that there is no way to get around that fact. So I learned to live with the things that can't be undone.
Well, you know, speaking of things that can't be undone, that leads me to another story in your new collection, and it's a story based on a memory, based on something that happened. The story is called The Holy Terror.
Yes.
And you wrote it in 1985 after the death of your older brother. I'm sorry, you wrote it in 1986 after his death in 1985. I think I have that right.
Close enough.
Yeah, okay. And what happened was when you were very, very young, your brother was trying to... when you were very, very young, your aunt was leaving in a horse and buggy, and your brother, who was a boy, wanted to go with her.
About five.
And he tried to climb up onto the buggy, and what happened?
Well, she didn't know he was there. He climbed up the wheel, and she was talking to my mother. And she finished her sentence and cracked the whip to make the horse move forward, and the wheels turned. And my brother slipped, and his... leg got caught in the wheel, and his leg was broken. And what I was told, I presume by my father, but somehow or other I acquired the information that it was broken in so many pieces that they had to cut it off. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s that an uncle who was a doctor told me that, in fact, it was a simple fracture that not once in 100 times ever required an amputation. But the family doctor was a drug addict because they used to dispense medicine, so they had access to drugs. And he didn't set the leg properly, and gangrene had set in, and that's why they had to cut it off. But my brother didn't know this, I'm quite sure. And I don't think his family knew it while he was alive.
Well, he never knew that?
No.
Boy, it would have been really hard for him to live with that.
It would have been unbearable. And I managed to keep the secret while we were both alive.
Was it hard for you to keep it a secret?
No, I had no desire. I just had a fear that he might find out, but I knew he wouldn't find out through me.
This is the kind of story I always find really frightening, in the sense that so many people have the kind of lives in which in one moment they made one foolish move that cost them something very dear that they could never get back.
Yes.
Like a leg.
And the leg, the price seems to be so disproportionate to the offense.
But a story like that can paralyze you. It can make you feel like, I better not make any move in case I make the wrong move.
I know, but we're animals and we have to move.
What you write in your story was that watching what happened to your brother changed you. You say, I became a more tractable, more even-tempered, milder person than it was in my true nature to be.
I think this is true, but it is not my perception. It was something which was said to me when I was in analysis by the psychoanalyst. He thought that there was a fierce character inside my rather gentle exterior, and that the reason that that exterior was so gentle was because the fierce character saw what happens to little. My father, my brother didn't just climb on that wagon. He did. He smoked cigars when he was 2 or 3, and he was, he was hell on wheels.
Right.
Yes.
Really willful.
My father had to lock up his cigar case.
Oh, gosh.
And he was 3 years old. And he turned the hose on the women of the family. He was full of beans. But then look what happened to him. So I think it might have, I can't swear to these things. Who can swear to anything psychological? It might have made me more quiet and gentle and bookish, but perhaps those were just my genes. I don't know. Who knows?
William Maxwell, recorded in 1995. He died Monday at the age of 91. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. We'll close this half hour with music by one of his favorite composers, Robert Schumann, performed by Marta Argerich. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, working as a fiction editor at The New Yorker, we hear more of our interview with William Maxwell, who died Monday at the age of 91. Then we'll talk more with writer Alec Wilkinson, who considered Maxwell his mentor and close friend. And Henry Sheehan reviews Space Cowboys, directed by and starring Clint Eastwood.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we're remembering William Maxwell. He died this week at the age of 91. He was the author of several novels and short story collections, and for nearly 40 years was a fiction editor at The New Yorker. J.D. Salinger, John Cheever, John Updike, and Vladimir Nabokov are some of the writers he edited. Let's continue our 1995 interview with Maxwell. From 1936 to 1975, you were a fiction editor at The New Yorker magazine. And since we're talking so much about memory, maybe you could remember for us a little bit what it was like to be at The New Yorker back in 1936.
It was a wonderful place. I was hired to see artists. That was the technical name for it. And there, at the moment, didn't seem to be any office space, so they put me in a bullpen, in a corner facing a drawing on the wall by Thurber of himself. But it was outside Mrs. White's office, and so I heard quite a lot that went on in the office, and she was a rather stately woman, very handsome and very stately, and when private matters were being discussed, she would get up from her desk in a stately fashion and walk to the doorstop and release it, and then between the time it took a rather slow door to close, I heard quite a lot. Anyway, she hired me, and Catherine White and Evie White and Wilkett Gibbs and Ross and Thurber, all half a generation older than I was. And I never felt that I was responsible for the making of the magazine, but I admired them. I also had reservations because I was already a novelist when I got there, and I read enormously, and I saw that there were certain areas that they were unwilling to touch.
Like what?
Well, it was astonishing now. They've long since got over that inhibition, but they wouldn't publish a story that involved the Jewish question. They wouldn't involve a story that involved homosexuality. There were several things that they felt simply inappropriate, which was formed a kind of straitjacket. Eventually, of course, everything and every kind of language has crept into The New Yorker, but this is the way it was when I went to work there.
As a fiction editor at The New Yorker, was it your responsibility to carry out certain parameters of discretion, you know, to respect certain parameters of discretion, so to speak, that you didn't really respect yourself?
I didn't have to carry them out. I just had to submit to them. For example, there was a John Cheever story which had the sentence in it, Coverley, with love in his heart and lust in his trousers, walked across the lawn. And the editor at that time, William Shawn, said that it couldn't be published. I thought it could be published. I didn't see why it couldn't be published. I thought it was a wonderful sentence, but it didn't get published.
Shawn won.
Shawn won.
Of course, I suppose.
Yes. 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 He had all the cards, but I think Wright was on my side.
So what was that exchange with Sean like? Were you in his office talking with him? Was this a back and forth on paper that happened?
It was in his office. He put it in on a when the manuscript came back, he said it should be cut. And so I went to his office to explain didn't think it should be cut. And I thought it was a good sentence. So he said it shouldn't, and I said it should stay in the story. And he said it shouldn't. So I just gave up and walked out of the office. What more could I do? I knew him well enough to know he wasn't going to change his mind.
And what did Cheever have to say about it?
I think I told John and apologized, but that's all that he had many grievances against The New Yorker, but that doesn't seem to have been one of them.
Did you feel like a New Yorker working at The New Yorker? You were from a small town in Illinois.
When I first went to work, I felt very different from them. At that particular moment, three plays of Noel Coward had just opened with Gertrude Lawrence, and there was a great deal of conversation about going to the opening nights, and I didn't go to opening nights. I'd never seen a Noel Coward play. I felt from the hinterlands. And in a sense, I remained from the hinterlands, but I stopped worrying about it and felt that's who I am, that's where I belong, and what the hinterlands have to offer is something as good as anywhere else. But I don't think I ever became, in any sense, I never felt sophisticated, and they were, rather. But strangely, only in certain areas. In other areas, they weren't. For example, E.B. White he did read Anna Karenina, but it took him 3 years. And he was not a reader at all. The whole vast areas of English and American classics were outside his experience, which isn't sophistication, is it?
Right.
But he's a very, very sophisticated writer.
I think of how much the world has changed since you were a boy, from, you know, horse and buggies to, you know, moonwalks and portable computers and all of that. Do you feel like you still make an effort to keep up with all the big changes, technological and otherwise, or is it not important to you now?
I don't say I make an effort not to keep up, but I certainly don't make any effort to keep up. For example, I use a typewriter, not a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Mitchell, my colleague at The New Yorker, is fond of a Quaker phrase, which is very convenient when there's some current manifestation. He says, it doesn't speak to my condition. And if you're 86, of course, lots of contemporary things don't speak to your condition. Your condition is placed 30, 40, 50, 60 years earlier. I liked the world I came into as a child. My father liked new things. He thought all the new inventions were marvelous. And in general, I've tended to hate them. I would so gladly put an end to all flying machines, all automobiles, all mechanical means of locomotion except the horse and buggy. It was a beautiful world. I loved the sound of a horse clop, cloppity, clop, clop going past the house. It was unhurried. It left time for brooding and thought. It left time for being nice to other people. It left time for making presents instead of buying them. It left time for telling stories.
I don't know if this is an answerable question or not, but what has given you the most pleasure about getting older, and what has been the most painful or most sad for you about it?
Nothing has been sad, strangely, but it's because the most serious losses haven't occurred. My wife is 13 years younger than I am, and she is still beautiful. She takes wonderful care of me. And so in the center of the operation, things are still secure. I don't mind. When I wrote that story about the man who kept a diary, I did, in fact, look out of the window and see children running down the street and think how wonderful it would be to run like that. But I've accepted the fact that I'm not going to run like that. And the other day, I went to the theater with a friend, and there were no taxis. It was a matinee, and there were no taxis. And we walked and walked and walked and walked. And finally, as we got close to Grand Central, I saw a stopped taxi with a light on and realized somebody was about to get out of it. And I ran. And I was so happy I could run. I don't say I ran very fast, but I covered the ground, and I got there before somebody else did. I love so many things about being old. For one thing, I'm quite charitable about most people and most things, and equally charitable toward my own shortcomings. And it makes for a pleasant state of mind. I love reading, and you can read. My eyesight's still fine. And I love gardening, and my knees, I'm able to kneel on. And so the wonderful opening out of memory, the wonderful fact that you look back over such a long period it's like having a marvelous novel. And my health is on the whole fine. So it's, I think old age is a minefield, but I've only stepped on one or two mines during that period.
So interesting to hear you talk about this. I feel like we get such mixed messages about aging. On the one hand, we all want to live a long time.
Yes, it is curious, isn't it?
And on the other hand, older people are always saying, whatever you do, don't get old.
No, I don't feel that way. I wouldn't have missed it for anything.
William Maxwell recorded in 1995 after the publication of a short story collection, All the Days and Nights. Maxwell died Monday at the age of 91. We'll hear more from a writer he mentored, Alec Wilkinson, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the conversation I recorded yesterday with writer Alec Wilkinson about the loss this week of his friend and mentor, William Maxwell. Maxwell was a fiction editor at The New Yorker for nearly 40 years. Wilkinson has written for The New Yorker since 1980. In fact, he wrote about Maxwell for the magazine last winter. He knew Maxwell since childhood, when Maxwell and Wilkinson's father were close friends. I know in the interview that I recorded with him in 1995, and he was 86 at the time, he said that he enjoyed getting older. He said, I wouldn't have missed it for anything.
Yeah.
And I wonder if his sense about age changed as he got older than 86, as he progressed toward 91, the age that he died at.
I think one of his pleasures in aging was the way in which his memory worked. And I think there was such a richness to his recollections that the quality of them were changing over time, that he as he got older, that I think was part of his pleasure in old age. Also, I think one of the satisfactions of old age for him were the numbers of younger people who'd been his friends. He'd lost so many of his friends who were his own age. His Robert Fitzgerald, who was always one of his closest friends from his days in college, almost everyone else had died. And even of the generation after that, many had died. But he had a lot of friends in their late 30s and 40s, poets especially, whose company delighted him. And I think he never, towards the end of his life, he had certain physical ailments, although nothing really, except he just kind of declined. His body slowed down on him, but he didn't deteriorate into any of the terrible. He always had a fear during the period when he was talking to you, he had said to me, "My 90s loom up before me with a kind of horror." And I think he thought that what would happen is that he would fall down a lot, or that he would break bones, or things like that. None of which really happened. He fell sometimes, but. Well, as anyone would.
William Maxwell's wife was 13 years younger than he was, and she died last week, just 1 week before he did.
Right, 8 days earlier.
You were at her bedside when she died. That's a privileged place to be. How did you come to be there with her?
I wasn't there when she died.
I'm sorry.
I think what you're thinking of is a wonderful day. The day before she died, there was a radiant, exalted sort of day where a number of her friends, the poet Edward Hirsch and Michael Collier, the poet, Bill, me, various friends of hers, all together, maybe eight people or so, were in the room, and her two daughters, Brookie and Kate, and the daughter of her oldest friend from Oregon were there. And we sang one of her favorite songs, had been the Cole Porter, the faux cowboy song, Don't Fence Me In, which she used to play on the jukeboxes when Bill was courting her. But she was from the West. She was from Oregon. She grew up on horseback. And she loved the song, and we all sang it to her around the bed, and Bill held her hand. And she said, "Why don't we open a bottle of champagne?" And we did, and we drank champagne and sang, and she closed her eyes and sang with us. She was one of the most beautiful women I've ever known and seen. Her beauty had a great deal to do with the radiance that was on display in her eyes, and even on that day, the next to last day of her life, in having had cancer for nearly 2 years and fought against it, her eyes just glowed. She smiled, and they just glowed. It's a day that nobody, I think, who was in the room will ever forget, and partly because of her immense courage and dignity and grace.
Do you think that it's not a coincidence that William Maxwell died within days of his wife dying?
Well, it's one of those complicated questions of whether or not it's possible to bring about our end. And I think that he was in such despair. Nobody ever thought a couple of years ago when Emily fell sick, Brookie, their daughter, said to me, I don't think, father won't last a week if mother goes. So I think that they were so in love. They'd been married 55 years. It was a great love story and immense intimacy between them. I've never seen anything like it. And it's always the idea that two people could love each other as much as they did has always been inspiring to me, and leaves one hopeful for the possibilities in one's own life. He was very downcast when she died, but I think also he went through a few days where he really was, I think, trying to get out of this world. And but then he decided one day that he really wanted to be around for his daughters and for his grandson. And he had stopped taking medication for whatever complications he had, and started taking it again, and had agreed to have a couple of treatments for things that he needed to keep going. So I last saw him on, I guess the day before he died, but I had expected to see him again.
Mm-hmm. What did your friendship with William Maxwell leave you thinking about old age?
Well, I guess I have two answers. One is that I certainly hope to hit a spectacular age like that. I think it was a great thing for him to be able to see his children grow up for as long as he did, and to be with them, and to see his grandson, and to be with Emmy for so many years. But I also think, really, what I think about Bill, and what I got more than anything else, was the deepest love that I've, other than for my wife and child, I have ever felt for anyone. And it's not particular to me and to Bill. I know everyone, all of his closest friends, Edward Hirsch, Annabelle Davis Goff, the writer, Shirley Hazard, the writer, Michael Collier, his daughters, we've all been talking on the phone these last few days, trying to console ourselves against something that is, of course, one can't console oneself against, and that's impossible to absorb, which is that this great man and this great woman are gone and exist only in our hearts.
Would you recommend a couple of William Maxwell's books for our listeners?
Sure. My favorite is So Long, See You Tomorrow, which is a novel about the Midwest in the early part of the century and a murder that took place there. I love the stories in Billy Dyer and other stories. I love his novel, The Chateau. I also love his collected stories, All the Days and Nights, which include not only a number of his stories, but several of the fables that he wrote as improvisations that are included in The Old Man at the Railroad Crossing. But there isn't anything that I don't take down off the shelf all the time and read through.
After William Maxwell died, was there any particular piece of his writing that you turned to bring back his voice?
Oh, God. I can't bear to. I can't look at it yet. It's just... Edward Hirsch told me yesterday that he was reading some of the stories, I'm in a borrowed house, and the only book on the shelf is So Long, of Maxwell's, is So Long, See You Tomorrow, and I can't go. I drown if I tried to read him now. I miss him so much.
Alec Wilkinson writes for The New Yorker. William Maxwell wrote the introduction to Wilkinson's book Midnights, which was recently published in paperback. Our remembrance of William Maxwell was produced by Roberta Sharrock. Coming up, a review of Clint Eastwood's new movie, Space Cowboys. This is Fresh Air. Clint Eastwood, Tommy Lee Jones, Donald Sutherland, and James Garner star in the new movie Space Cowboys. Eastwood is also the film's producer and director. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
I had always considered Clint Eastwood to be one of Hollywood's best filmmakers, a true student of his mentor Don Siegel, who made tough, spare movies such as Dirty Harry and Escape from Alcatraz, but also adventurous ones such as The Beguiled. But since 1992's Unforgiven, Eastwood's films have gotten even better. The actor-director has explored with steady profundity the whys and wherefores of the movie hero. His characters have seen their professionalism called into question and their emotional stability wrenched, each a self-conscious violation of the traditional movie hero's code. In his latest film, Space Cowboys, Eastwood continues this line of inquiry, though in a much more lighthearted vein than usual. It's not that the movie is a comedy, though it has a sheaf of comic scenes. It's more that it's willing to bear itself aloft on the wings of pure fantasy and wish fulfillment. Eastwood once again puts his notion of heroism to the test, but this time the movie's tone lets us know from the start that everything, or mostly everything, is going to be all right. Eastwood stars as Frank Corvin, a hard-boiled test pilot and engineer living in retirement in the California desert. One day, he's visited by a NASA scientist and astronaut who have a problem. A Russian communications satellite is going to crash into Earth unless a space crew get into orbit and repair it. The complication is that the satellite's design is based on the one Frank built for Space Lab, an archaic system no one understands anymore. For Frank, the situation is more than a chance to help his country. It's an opportunity for vindication. Back in 1958, he and three buddies had been Air Force hotshots, training to be the nation's first astronauts. Then one inglorious day, their superior, the same man who needs him now, had told them that they were being replaced by a monkey. Frank now wants to round up his three buddies, who are collectively known as Team Daedalus, and take back their chance to go into space. The three are played by a trio of actors who mere presence add to the movie's pleasure. Tommy Lee Jones is Hawk Hawkins, who is always the dare-taker to Frank's more uptight self. Donald Sutherland is Jerry O'Neill, the team womanizer. And James Garner plays Tank Sullivan, the group's peacemaker. Eastwood encourages each of them to show off their star qualities, the appealing traits that make them and him stars in the first place. Here, after a long absence, Frank recruits Hawk for the mission.
What are you doing here?
Filling the promise I made 40 years ago.
Was that the promise you made to kill me, or was that the promise you made to have both of my legs broke?
It was the other one. I'm working on a little blackmail with NASA. Mm-hmm.
Huh? They've got a satellite that's going to crash unless they can fix the guidance system.
I'm guessing you designed that guidance system.
Yeah. They're desperate. Even Gersten's in on the deal. I told him I'd only do it if the original Team Daedalus did the job.
That scene is a great example of Eastwood's narrative economy. On one level, it's just an expository moment. But we are also getting quite a bit of character information. In an opening flashback, we've seen young Hawk as a brash daredevil. Clearly, something has been taken out of him since, though not so much that echoes of his old rivalry with Frank don't come up. That's the key to Eastwood's style. Like those by the great filmmakers of Hollywood's past, Howard Hawks, John Ford, and yes, Don Siegel, Eastwood's movies aren't really about plot. Eastwood's movies are about character and how character is revealed in bursts of action. Space Cowboys opens with a terrific black and white sequence set in 1958, displaying the quartet at the height of their youthful daring and bravado. When they do come back, when it's absolutely necessary, they have to prove they are still up to the task. But after they finally go into space, for a marvelous 45-minute effects sequence, by the way, the tables are turned. They reclaim their status as heroes. Substitute Hollywood Studios for NASA, and you can easily read Space Cowboys as a commentary on the recent history of movies, a time when heroes went from riding horses to being ridden with effects. Eastwood reminds us that it's not the vehicle that counts so much as the men or stars that drive them.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. On Monday, with reluctance, we have to start doing something we haven't done in 13 years, produce Fresh Air without Naomi Person. You have her to thank for the great actors and directors who've been our guests on Fresh Air in the past few years. She's leaving for an arts journalism fellowship at Columbia University. We look forward to getting her back when the fellowship concludes. Naomi, we'll miss you. Keep in touch and let us know what life is like outside the Fresh Air offices. Just don't get too used to it. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was directed today by Sue Spolin. Our thanks to Max Forrester for his help this week. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com, and from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our series on American popular song concludes with our tribute to Hoagie Carmichael, the composer of Stardust, Skylark, Heart and Soul, and Georgia on My Mind. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.